भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुर्मीलितां येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवये नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं दधाति शपदान्तिकम्। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरौ श्रीजुतापदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणारघुनाथान्वितं स्थं सजीवम् साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवम् श्रीराधाकृष्णपादान् सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिकाकान्ता राधाकान्त नमोऽस्तुते। तप्ताकांशन गौरङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी वृषभनुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये। वाञ्छाकोपितृभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धोभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यप्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैतगदाधर श्रीवासादिगौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Cell phone check, please. All cell phones should be tame. Today, with the permission of Suvas Prabhu, we'll do something a little different. And that is, I'll speak something about my book, forthcoming in April or May from the BBT. Perhaps I should start by reading Srimad Bhagavatam and then segue into this, but time will run out. So if we're going to be heretical, we'll just be 100% heretical and do something different. But it will be Bhagavad Gita. The book is called Vanity Karma. It's a book-length commentary on the Book of Ecclesiastes, which is one of the books of the Old Testament of the Bible, or what the Jews would call the Hebrew Scriptures. It's a very unusual book in the Bible, because it's not prophecy, it's not law, it's not hymns, it's rather questioning and doubting, more and raising philosophical issues. Sometimes it's said that this is the one philosophical book in the whole Old Testament. Some questions. It was written at an uncertain date. Some say that it's written by King Solomon, which would place it back, 3,000 years back. Most modern scholars would say that it's written sometime around the 3rd century B.C. The author is unknown, and how it got into the Bible is also an open question, except that perhaps because it was attributed to Solomon, that was enough to get it in. There are other explanations also. Everything about the book is debated. One scholar says that it's sort of an old saying that there are as many interpretations of Ecclesiastes as there are scholars or interpreters. He said, no, actually there's more, because some of the interpreters have changed their mind. The key word in the text is a Hebrew word translated, at least in the King James Version, as vanity. Vanity in this context doesn't mean pride and looking at yourself in a mirror and thinking how good you look. It means futility. It's variously translated futility, emptiness, meaninglessness. When we say that something is in vain, we mean that it's for nothing. It's pointless. If I labored in vain, it means I didn't get any result. And then why was I working? So vanity is the noun form of vain. It means that which is pointless, meaningless, fruitless, of no use. One translator has said absurd. There are different meanings. The main speaker is someone who calls himself or is called Qohelet. There's no historical person by that name in the Bible, but in the beginning of the book, at least, he speaks of himself in such a way as that he's identified with King Solomon, the great king of wisdom and wealth. And I'm going to jump into the first chapter of Qohelet, or Ecclesiastes. The format of the book is that I have the text from the Bible, and then I have some commentary. I may not read much directly from the commentary because it's easier for me to summarize it, but we'll see. This is his opening words. The words of Qohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says Qohelet. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit does a man have from all his labor at which he labors under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation comes, and the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to his place where he arises. The wind goes toward the south, and it circles to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers go, there they go again. All things toil to weariness, more than man can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it might be said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of the people of former times, nor of the people of times to come will there be any remembrance among those who come after. So this is his opening shot. He says, in essence, that everything is meaningless. Everything is pointless. He references nature, where the sun is rising and setting and rising and setting. It doesn't really go anywhere. It just goes through all that hard work of rising and setting. The rivers, the wind, everything just goes round and round, and nothing new ever happens. People come, people go, a generation passes, new generation comes and does what the previous generation did before it. And whoever did whatever, they're forgotten. And we're going to be forgotten next. So all of this hard work, and what is the purpose? That's his opening question. or his opening complaint, really, that everything in this world is meaningless. So then he tries to, he has a program to try to understand things and to solve his problem by wisdom. I, Kohelet, have been the king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is a sore task that God has given to men to be busy with. I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and just see, all is vanity and a chasing after wind. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be counted. I spoke with my heart, saying, just see, I've gotten great wisdom, more also than all who were before me over Jerusalem. Indeed, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also was a chasing after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. So this was his first approach. Let me become wise. And he says elsewhere that I became wiser than all of my predecessors in Jerusalem. And finally, what does he see? He sees that it's all vanity, it's all useless. And another metaphor he uses, another figure he uses, it's a chasing after wind. A person who's chasing after wind is getting nothing. The more knowledge, the more vexation. In the Bhagavatam, it said that in the third canto, the Paramhansas and the fools are happy. Paramhansas are happy because they're Paramhansas. They're always absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And the fools are happy because they're fools. They're bewildered by the illusory energy covered by the covering potency of Maya. So they're happy also. But those who are in between, the Bhagavatam says, they're pricked by the troubles of this material world. So he finds himself in that position that he can't solve his problem by wisdom. And he sees that the world can't be fixed. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. Welfare won't work. New inventions, new machines, new five-year plans. Nothing is going to straighten the world out. That which is crooked is going to stay crooked. And that which is wanting, that which is lacking, you can't estimate. And it's always going to be like that. So then he tries another experiment, another approach. I said in my heart, come now, let me make you try pleasure. Enjoy what is good. And just see, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to ply my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what is best for men to do under heaven the few days of their life. I made great works. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and parks, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. I made myself pools from which to water the forests springing up with trees. I bought men and women as servants and had servants born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got myself singers, both men and women, and many concubines, mistresses, the delights of men. So I became great and flourished more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. And also my wisdom stood with me. Nothing that my eyes desired did I keep from them, nor did I withhold my heart from any joy, for my heart had joy in all my labor, and this was my portion from all my labor. Then I turned to look upon all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor I had labored to do, and just see, all was vanity and a chasing after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So this was his second experiment. Wisdom didn't work. Let's try pleasure. And essentially he tried Jnana-kanda. Now he's trying Karma-kanda. He doesn't just pig out, but we find he builds houses, he creates like a second Eden for himself, really. Flocks and gardens and palaces and gold and all the things that a king is entitled to. He thinks, let me enjoy it and not hold back. Because if you hold back, you don't know. You didn't really take the experiment all the way. Someone will say, well, you held back. I won't hold back. I'll go all the way and I'll watch myself do it. He's going to keep his wisdom, and he's going to enjoy and watch the experiment. That's the project. And to see what might be best for men to do under heaven the few days of their life. He knows that the days are few, and this is his approach. Quite a contrast to Maharaj Parikshit. He had 7 days left to live. He went to the side of the Ganges. He asked the same question, what should a man do with the few days of his life? But fortunately, he heard from Sukadeva Goswami, you should hear about Krishna. If you want fearlessness at the time of death, you should hear about Krishna. And the king spent his last 7 days in that way. But this king is taking the experimental method. He tries wisdom, and wisdom in his context means trying to figure things out. It's not hearing from authorities, iti shushumadhiranam. It's speculating and trying to understand and putting together his experience and deducing what is what. And he just gets bewildered or perplexed or frustrated. Then he tries pleasure, grand style, and at the end, what's the use? What's the use? He said, I enjoyed my portion. God has allotted everyone a certain portion, so this is what God's given me. Let me enjoy it. That doesn't work. there's no profit when you add up the balance sheet. It's like a business. At the end of the business, you worked so hard, you knocked yourself out, and then you look at your balance sheet, and it shows that you made no profit. And what was the use of all that work? So he looks at the project of life in this world and says, where's the profit? I'm skipping a little bit. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as much as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And I perceived also that one event happens to them all. Then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so will it happen even to me. And why then have I become so very wise? Then I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For there's no lasting remembrance of the wise man any more than of the fool. In the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. And how must the wise man die just like the fool? So he says, well, relatively, knowledge is better than ignorance. Relatively speaking, he concludes, knowledge is better than ignorance. But then he says, still, what's the use? One thing happens to everyone. Everyone dies. The wise man, the fool, they both go to the same graveyard and they're both forgotten. What is the difference? What is the use? That's his question. So this is this is called Prashna. There's a Prashna Upanishad. This is human life, Brahma Jigyasa, to ask why am I here? What is the purpose of my life? Manusyanam sahasreshu kaschid yadati siddhaye. Out of thousands of among human beings, one will come to this platform. Others will just busy themselves either in sense gratification or in the useless pursuit of mundane knowledge and waste their life. And some small number will ask themselves, what is the purpose of my life? Why am I here? And for them, all sorts of guidance counselors, psychiatrists, and others will be assigned to help him get past it so that he can go on living uselessly. So Kohelet goes on. There's 12 chapters. I've only read a little bit. Not very long. It's about 200 verses, I think, 212 verses, 222. And we see that what happens is that he gets confused. One scholar has referred to Kohelet as a confused wise man. On the one side, he says, it's all useless. Then what does he say? He gives other examples. He says, you work so hard your whole life, and then you have to leave it all to your son or descendant, and you don't know whether he'll be a wise man or a fool. He may just throw away everything you've given him. Huh? Run the business into the ground, ruin the kingdom. You're working so hard for them, and you don't know what they're going to do with it. Well, many examples he gives of how one spends this life for nothing. Then on the other side, he says, well, what is there? He says, well, God has given some little portion of enjoyment So you should enjoy that, because that's what God has given you. So he's already concluded that enjoyment doesn't work. But then he goes back to it because there's nothing better. He says there's nothing better than to eat and drink and to be happy. There's nothing better. Not that it's great, but there's nothing better. So he goes back to that. Then he goes the other way and says, well, everything is useless and we're all going to die. And then he flips back the other way and says, enjoy. Toward the end of the book, he's advising a young man or his son that you should enjoy. It becomes now not just an observation, but an imperative. You should enjoy. Why should you enjoy? Because soon the days will come when you'll say, oh, there's no enjoyment in them. And then he describes very vividly how one dies. So his enjoyment is always right next door to death. And he's flip-flopping between the two. You can say bhoga tyaga. On the one side, enjoy. On the other side, say, ah, this is useless. And then go back to it and chew the chewed again. So this is Kohelet. There's much more in the book. In the third chapter, there's a beautiful description about time and seasons that was adapted into a song, which is perhaps still popular. There's many famous passages in the book also. I'm just giving a brief outline. His outlook, and in the book I'm sometimes amplifying what he says, sometimes agreeing, and sometimes critiquing his worldview and observing that it's all within one little lifetime. He never goes beyond this life. At one point he says, who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the animal goes down. That's the most he says. Who knows? So he essentially dismisses it, because who knows? And with all the questions that he asks himself, the one question he never asks is, who am I? Never asks it. The whole Vedic literature begins with that question, who am I? And for Kohelet, I'm Kohelet. And one commentator explains that in the worldview of his time, there was no separate soul. I am this body. I am this body. That's who I am. And therefore, when the body is finished, I'm finished. And therefore, what's the use of my life? That's inevitably where it goes. He does have God in his book, but in fact, we found as God, the first time God appears, it's a sore task that God has given man to begin with. God is a troublemaker. He's the one responsible for the way the world is. And he's a very distant figure in Kohelet's worldview. He's implanted within us the desire to understand what is what. And he's played his cards so close to his chest that no one can answer that question. No one can understand it. So these are some of the issues that we take up in the book. And maybe rather than speak more, I'll take some questions. Yes? Excuse me? What's that book doing in the Bible? That's a very good question. And scholars have answered this variously. It's a very unusual book to be in the Bible. Usually we hear that we should fear God, we should tremble before the Almighty, or we should obey strictly what he says, or we should glorify him, or love him with all our heart. And here we find that God has made a crooked world where there's nothing means anything, that he has afflicted his poor creatures with this meaningless existence, a very unusual book. But what is it doing in the Bible? One answer I've already given, that it was attributed traditionally to Solomon, and so that's sort of a credentials. Like if we said that this book is written by Srila Rupa Goswami, you'd say, okay, well, Rupa Goswami wrote it, then. So it's written by Solomon. Okay, it's in. That was one answer. Another answer is that there's a narrator who comes in at the very, very beginning and at the very end. He just has a few words to say. And at the end, he says, after Kohelet has presented his whole discourse, says, well, the sum of the matter is that you should fear God and obey his commandments, for that's the whole substance of man. He says a few words about Kohelet. He says, well, Kohelet was a sage, and he wrote words of wisdom, and he arranged many proverbs, and here's the conclusion. So the rabbis looked at that and when they were debating the subject, and they said, well, it ends with the words of the Torah. It ends with the words of the law. That's bona fide. Fear God, obey his commandments. Okay. It's in. One commentator has observed that after Kohelet gives this powerful argument for the total meaninglessness of all existence, that everything just ends in death, the narrator comes in and says, well, Kohelet was a wise fellow, and he wrote many proverbs, and here's the conclusion. He said it's as if someone were speaking about Karl Marx, and there's a specter haunting Europe, workers of the world unite. And then he summarizes and said, well, Karl Marx had a lot of ideas, and he wrote some bad love poetry also, and you know, just sort of trivializing everything. It's a total non sequitur, actually. Kohelet gives argument after argument for why this world, life in this world, is pointless, meaningless, absurd, frustrating. It's a powerful case. And the narrator just comes in and says, well, conclusion is love God and follow everything he says. No argument, no evidence, just that's the conclusion. Anyway, that was there, so that helped. Another reason given is that the Bible was not, the contents of the Bible were not settled up in, at least the Old Testament, in conferences or in a process of decision making where they sat down with all the books and said, okay, this one's in, not that one's out, this one's in. It was a process that took place over generations. One scholar describes the biblical literature as being a national literature on a religious foundation. He says that among these writings, some of them gradually came to be respected as scripture. And the thinking goes along this line of thought, that Kohelet was such a good book, the arguments were so meaningful, the arguments were so much to the point, that it had traction. That the book, you couldn't say, no, we're going to dump this. It was valued, and so it was kept. There are other books in the Bible also where you ask yourself, what's this doing there? Song of Songs is probably the most vivid example. But Song of Songs you can allegorize and say, well, it really is about this. Kohelet is very clear what it's about. Anyway, somehow or other, it sneaked in. And so we have it. Subhas Prabhu. Microphone.
What inspired you to actually take this particular portion of the Bible and write this particular book.
Yeah, thank you. I explained that in the introduction to the book. One reason is because it was personally meaningful for me when I was a young man, maybe 13 or 14, I encountered this book, and it was, whoa. It just changed everything. You know, I immediately understood what he was saying. And when you understand that, your life goes to hell. So that started me on a process by which I finally wound up sitting here. So that's one answer. They say you should write about what you care about. So it was meaningful. Another is because it presents such an excellent, the questions it asks are so vital, so important, so crucial. And it provides a very suitable platform, yeah, a very engaging place to be, or a very suitable point of engagement. That's maybe what I want to say. It gives us something from a world outside of Krishna consciousness, that is outside of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, something from the larger culture that is really worth engaging in, or engaging with, really worth addressing. To write a commentary on the songs of Mick Jagger or the politics of Obama or something, it's just not as, doesn't have the same weight as this book. So it provides a point of engagement, and I've written the book mainly for outsiders. For devotees, you don't need this book. You have Srimad Bhagavatam, you can skip everything else. But it provides a point of engagement for outsiders. And it's with them in mind that I've written the book. Mm-hmm.
Would you say that, did you write it in order to, like, maybe challenge the Bible or somehow discredit the Bible? Or?
No, not at all. In fact, I really don't take on the Bible. The Bible's big. Judaism is big. Christianity is big. My knowledge about both of them is small. And for me to take on the Bible would be too much. Apart from that, my agenda is not to discredit the Bible nor to say, well, see how much we share in common. Actually, we're all saying the same thing. I have no patience for that. My engagement is with this one particular book, with this one particular sage. Okay, I throw a couple of, I do reference a few other biblical quotations here and there that are relevant, but I'm not trying to comment on Jewish culture, Christian culture, the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament. It's really just this one sage, Kohelet, and what he has to say. That's the point of engagement. That's the platform.
So that means that if we just heard some points there from the book itself. So you're taking those particular points and expanding on them in your commentary?
Yes.
And it's the philosophy of Krishna consciousness?
Yes. That's what it's really about. It's about, I don't care if Kohelet is Jewish, Christian, 3,000 years ago, 300 years ago, 3 weeks ago. What matters to me are his ideas and the power behind those ideas, the power of his expression and the depth of his problem, because he really feels it. You can, when you read the book, you see that he's not just like a philosopher saying, well, this is a perennial question that philosophers have had to deal with, and you can look at it this way, you can look at it that way. It's really in his guts. He's really troubled. He's really afflicted by the conclusions that have thrust themselves upon him, almost inevitably. So that's the problem that I hope some of my readers will also have felt or will feel? Because how do you make progress in spiritual life unless you perceive that something's wrong? If life is hunky-dory, then what do you need Krishna consciousness for? You can just be a fool. And the fools are happy. Or if you're a Paramahansa, you don't need to read my book either because you're already there. But for those who are in the middle, who are pricked by the thorns of Maya, these issues matter. So I've picked them up from Kohelet, and sometimes I agree with him, sometimes I disagree with him, taking ideas from Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. I don't hold back. It's not my style to pussyfoot or sort of introduce things kind of in a under the covers kind of way. It's all out there up front, that you're not this body, that life is meant for spiritual realization, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that we're all meant to serve him, that God has three features, Brahma, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, that Bhagavan is the highest feature, that impersonalism stinks, that materialistic scientists are off track. All of Prabhupada's themes that he hammered into us, I've tried to express in the course of the book. Yes. Looks like we're headed to the ladies' area. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. I have a similar experience. When I was studying the Bible in high school, this was my favorite book because it actually confirmed that in my life that God is needed. Probably one of the more convincing books of the Bible to me because it's like a book without God, the perspective without him, you know. And so it was kind of disturbing like that. But the song that you mentioned, is it Turn?
It is.
I just made that connection. I think it's like for everything there's a time, like grief.
For everything there's a season and a time to every purpose under heaven.
So what in Krishna consciousness is that? Maybe like happiness and distress? There's always those seasons.
How do I comment on that section? It's a very beautiful section in the third chapter, and it's usually read as a very harmonious sort of statement. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, there's a time for this and a time for that, and everything's in its place, everything's sort of balanced and harmonious. And it does have an expression of that. In the commentary, I raise the question why there's time at all, what time is, and why it's there. Why does time have to be there? And what is this time thing? You know, like why is there time? So I raise that question, and the conclusion is, of course, that Krishna himself is time. So you can't deny Krishna, because what is God? God means he's all powerful, he's everywhere, he's absolute. And I'm an atheist, I don't accept that there's God. But you have to. You have to accept that there's an all-powerful, absolute, all-pervasive truth. Because that all-pervasive, all-powerful truth is going to knock you over the head. It's finally going to put you flat and send you out. You can't deny that. So, as Prabhupada said, it's just whether you accept God as Krishna or whether you accept God as death. But you have to accept that there's an absolute authority. So that's one issue that I deal with there. I also talk about the various items. He mentions a time to reap and a time to sow, a time to gather stones and a time to scatter stones. All these things are there. So I talk about the individual things. In the commentary, my usual approach is, first I try to say what the book is saying, because if you don't, it's not always clear what the text itself is saying at face value. So first I address that, well, what's Qohelet saying? And then I go, well, how do we look at that from the point of Bhagavad Gita? What's most interesting about that particular text is that after this very genuinely beautiful poetic description of the balance of all things and the place for all things within the arrangement of time, Qohelet follows it immediately by saying, what profit do people get from all the work that they perform in this world? He's back to his old complaint again. So out of context, it's this very beautiful text, and people love the song, you know, there's a time for everything. But in context, there's a time for everything, and it's all useless. Or, okay, whoever's meant to go.
So in verse 7.3 in Bhagavad Gita, as you started to quote, Manushyanam Sahasreshu, in the translation, it says that of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. It would seem like that's like an apparent contradiction.
Yeah, Siddhanam, generally Prabhupada glosses Siddhanam means those who've realized that they're not this body, that they're spirit, those who've realized at least the impersonal aspect of the Absolute, they're Siddhas. The rest of us are thinking sense gratification, job, family, bank balance. But some sages realize their spiritual identity, realize that life is meant for self-realization, realize that this world is only a product of the material energy. Well, they're called siddhas. But out of thousands of them, hardly one knows Krishna.
So it's possible to achieve perfection in this life and not...
Sure. Just like even materially, you know, like Steve Jobs attained perfection. You know, he was rich, he was famous, he had apples all over the place. So that was material perfection. Then there's a spiritual perfection, to know that you're not this body. But that's not the ultimate perfection.
Okay. I understand that.
Thank you, Maharaj. I had questions, but you already answered my question. But if you allow me to, comparing all the analogies that you were making and all the questions and answers that this personality had, I came across that many devotees already had that in our Srimad Bhagavatam with stories of kings and so many things. So then obviously I thought, well, yeah, we already have the answer. You're doing this for confirmation for the outside people. So if you allow me to, Maharaj, I would like to read a verse here that called my attention in regards to this. From the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.5 says, Munayo sadupristo aham bhavabdhir loka mangalam yad krita krishna samprasno yenadma suprasidati. This is Sutta Goswami, who's answering to the sages who are asking many questions. O sages, I have been justly questioned by you. Your questions are worthy because they are related to Lord Krishna and so are so relevant to the world's welfare. Only questions of this sort are capable of completely satisfying the self. So obviously this person, right, no guru, no guidance.
He doesn't have a guru.
No Krishna.
And he doesn't wind up with the conclusion of devotional service. God is there. He's dangerous. In one scholar's words, he's a cosmic bully. He could smite you at any moment. But he doesn't have this sense of love for God and devotional service for God. especially not as the constitutional engagement of the living being. God's put us here, and, well, the best we can do is enjoy because he gave us some enjoyment. It's really not on the same level. And so, yenatma supersediti, he's not supersediti, he's not very happy at all. It's just like, well, I guess this is the most you get.
Thank you, Maharaj. I was just wondering if there's any Vedic parallels to this, which like calls into question like previously like established ideas.
There's a lot in the Vedic tradition, like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu calls into question, you know, the whole Vedic tradition before him in terms of rigid caste systems and sacrifices and this and this, and he says you can attain perfection just by chanting Hare Krishna. So that's totally radical. There's a lot of radical stuff going on in the Vedic world. Suvas Prabhu.
Interesting questions you brought up here. And I thought it would be nice to share it, and that is, after hearing, you know, this particular philosopher or king or Solomon, whoever wrote it, and hearing his particular analysis, but not coming to the conclusion. It's amazing because Prabhupada says the conclusion is Bhaktaram Jakap Tapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram Suridam Sarvabhutanam Gyatavamam Santim Richati, which means that unless we accept God as the supreme proprietor, friend, enjoyer, then we're an atheist. We're a sense gratifier, you're a thief, and you're everything bad. So it seems that this is apropos in the Bible, because people don't know who God is, and their whole philosophy is based just on what this is all about. Sense gratification, stealing, thieving, proprietorship.
Well, again, I don't want to pass value judgments on the Bible as a whole, because it's beyond my purpose and
right.
Competence. But certainly in terms of this book, he doesn't seem to get it. He has it. God is there. God is finally the boss. But the sense that I should live for God's happiness, that I'm part, the way the hand is part of the whole body and is meant to serve the whole body, that he just doesn't get. It just doesn't arrive on his horizon.
But he doesn't really derive an understanding of God at the end of this particular...
Yeah, and there's no argument for it. I mean, we can say, well, Bhaktaram Yajna Tapasam, surrender to Krishna, da 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 da, and people can say, yeah, you know, surrender to God. But in our literature, there's a whole philosophy that is integral to that. So it's not just sort of like a jack-in-the-box that comes out and says, love God, love God, love God. There's a whole substrate. There's starting from analysis of matter and spirit, understanding our identity, understanding the Supreme. So much is there in the Vedic writings. Yes?
Maharaj, in the book that you mentioned, the questions that he's asking and the observations that he's making, can they be called Brahma Jigyasa, or Brahma Jigyasa is different?
Yeah, you can call it Brahma Jigyasa. Brahma Jigyasa essentially asks, what's the greatest, Brihat? What's the greatest? What's the highest purpose? Finally, what is Brahma? What's the absolute? Strictly speaking, Brahma Jigyasa means inquiring about the absolute. But I'd say he falls within that circle. He's asking what the purpose of life is. He's asking what the ultimate is. He's asking how things make sense. That's called prashna. Yeah, or Brahma Jigyasa. He's certainly among those who are... He's not just another complacent Joe saying, okay, should I be an engineer, a doctor, or a lawyer? He's deeply disturbed by the failure of the world to make any sense. And that's the beginning platform for spiritual realization. I should say also another reason behind the book or another thought behind the book is that many times some of our young people, our second generation people, have asked me, what is it that got you energized about this? You know, we have a sort of baseline Krishna consciousness because we were born into it. Our parents were devotees. So we accept that that Krishna is God. We're vegetarians. We like kirtan. But it's kind of lifestyle for us. It's not urgent. It's not like a fire that's raging. It's just kind of like, yeah, Krishna's God, and we like being with the devotees, and it's fun to see the deities. But it's not, you know, what got you to just like hand over your life to Prabhupada, you and the other members of your generation? What is it that flipped you from where you were to that? So I've tried to answer that question also in a way that would be meaningful for them or for any young person or older person in that position. What is it that commands you to do something more than just work and get paid and enjoy your weekend? And this is where these are the sort of questions that spoil our fun for the better. Yes, Ben Bhattacharya.
Maharaj, I'm wondering, and maybe I apologize if I missed it during your talk, but I'm wondering what is the main, if there is one particular one, what the main objective is in terms of writing the book. In other words, if there's, you know, a specific class people you're trying to reach, because you said it's generally not for devotees.
Yes. And that's a project for me and the BBT is to identify reachable audiences. We could say, well, it's for everybody out there, but everybody is too many people and too vague. But there are different audiences that I have in mind. One is a scholarly audience. There's a realm of academic discourse concerning the Old Testament and Ecclesiastes in particular. So it falls within the realm of Ecclesiastes studies, Old Testament studies, interreligious dialogue, and what's known as reception of the Bible. You know, how do other people, or even Christian people and non-Christian people, how do they receive the Bible? How do they respond to it? How do they react to it? That's a whole academic field. There's also a field called Indo-Judaic studies. So there's a scholarly audience. That's one audience. But more important for me is the audience of people who are seeking for spiritual truth, who weren't only a strange species that appeared in the 1960s and died out by 1972. They're still out there. They're always out there. People for whom materialistic life just doesn't add up and who are therefore looking for something more meaningful.
Okay. So you had mentioned there are many other commentaries already on this particular work?
Yeah, there are many, many commentaries on Ecclesiastes. I can at least say, without being boastful, that this will not be the worst commentary.
But that's what I'm wondering, is how is your commentary, you know, different, or how
the difference is that
it will lighten people?
There's no other commentary which addresses Ecclesiastes from the Vedic point of view. Uh-huh. There's a brief essay that looks at Ecclesiastes through the lens of the I Ching. There's another brief essay that looks at it from the point of view of Lao Tzu. But those are just sort of brief exchanges. There's no full-length discourse on Ecclesiastes whatsoever coming from, as far as I know, any Indian tradition, and especially not from the point of view of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's unique in that sense. By the way, there's lots of commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita from the Christian point of view. Some of them better, some of them worse. But there's nothing going the other way. This is, as far as I know, the first time.
I was hoping you'd give us a little more taste of your commentary on it so we can actually...
Yeah, I would have read a portion, except that we're constrained within 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and that doesn't really give us time to do it. Maybe another occasion, either in another class or another gathering, I could read a little bit.
Thank you, Maharaj. Mm-hmm.
But it's all, it reads like me, you know. I say the same stuff whether I'm talking or writing. But I try to do it a little more professionally when it's in writing. You know, when you talk, it's a bit of a ramble. When you write, you have to be disciplined. And we will look for another occasion to read something, give a taste. We're at our time. Speaking of time and there being a time for everything, I think we're out of time.
The North American BBT will be printing this book for Dvaita Maharaj. We're very happy to do that. And we want to market this book as much as possible and get as many of these as we can get out there. So please be looking forward to that book and let's distribute thousands. Hari Bol.
Also, if there's anyone who'd like to get involved in any way in helping, there are lots of things to do with website construction and promotion and all sorts of things that need to be done, research for. So if you have an interest in getting involved in any way, drop me a line or come see me.
So Maharaj, I was just informed that you will be giving a program next Saturday.
I'm doing a program next Saturday.
Yes. At Nam Avatar's place, which is down the street here.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a good spot to also speak a little bit about this.
Yeah, I could.
Invite devotees to come.
Yeah.
It starts at 6:30 next Saturday. Oh, okay. So we have another program today with Mugunda Dat Prabhu. And that's going to be where? At Suresh Krishna's home.
Suresh Krishna's house?
He is just down the street.
He is Mukunda Datta at 11 o'clock today.
Yes.
Okay. Nidwarka ki
jai.
Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Premanande. Hari Hari Bol. Excuse me? We're looking at...